everyone. Welcome to That Jesus Podcast, where we explore genuine discipleship to the Prince of Peace in a world gone to pieces. Okay, maybe that's not the best of taglines. I'm still working on it. If you guys have any suggestions or ideas for a tagline, hopefully if you listened to last episode, you know where I'm headed in this podcast post-Titus, but really want to lean into the concept of Jesus as a Prince of Peace in a world of conflict and how for many of us who've wrestled through what Jesus doesn't teach now, how do we present winsome, holistic vision of Jesus and following him? So today I'm going to do that with a friend, I guess. I guess I can call David a friend, even though I don't really know him that much. He's a dude on Twitter. And, you know, that's always a pretty sketchy bunch. But I've enjoyed following David's Twitter account and asked him to come on and talk about his journey into nonviolence and his relationship with Jesus and family and marriage and whatever else we get into. So welcome aboard, David.
Thanks, Drew. Happy to be here.
And you're hailing from the not terribly mediocre state of Texas, right?
Yeah. One of the big parts, a little bit wide open here.
Yeah. I have some dead-in-the-wool Texas fans here, so I have to diss them just a little bit.
Well, let me just say hello to all my Texas buddies. I know what it feels like.
Yeah, you sound like you're from Texas.
I do, really.
So I started following you on Twitter a while ago, and you were sharing really interesting things about nonviolence and kind of politics from at least a somewhat Jesus perspective. But I think what really caught my mind was when this guy David started showing up on my Twitter feed is your bio. And so I'm just going to read your Twitter bio. You start off with a V and an A, which I'm not even sure what that means. But then you have a peace sign, a cross sign, a dove sign, followed by a libertarian, voluntarist / anarchist, tolerant Christian fundamentalist, happily married, homeschooling father of 8 kids, proud non-voter. That is quite a mouthful, sir. Do you want to unpack that for me?
Yeah, it is. And some of it's designed to be a little bit of an attention getter or maybe an attention provoker, but all of it's heartfelt. And okay. If you want, I'm going to pull it up here on my own screen and just go through each piece of it there. The V and the A are kind of the same thing. The A in a circle is kind of well known as an anarchist symbol. And a lot of people seem to miss it talking to me on Twitter, but I am an anarchist. I don't believe in government.
Well, for an anarchist, what better place than Twitter, right?
Well, yeah. Of course, to me, the word anarchy doesn't necessarily mean, you know, chaos and throwing Molotov cocktails and things. But yeah, government-wise, I'm that. And the V in the circle stands for voluntarism, which is spelled out there a little bit later in my bio, just in particular the thought of the government seeing itself as an enemy of the people, seeing itself as afraid of people, trying to make people afraid of it. It's a tension that I think is very real. But really, it's mostly about the voluntarism. And I'll spell that out here in a minute when I get to that slashed part. The next symbol is the peace sign. That's the what they call the CND logo, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Or as a lot of people know it, the hippie symbol, the crow's foot. Mm-hmm. And that stands for the fact now, that I oppose you? War. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, now to pause you there, I think I would have grown up, at least some of the sources I would have read would have said, but that's a broken cross or an upside down cross. And it's actually a satanic symbol because pursuing peace or rejecting patriotism is definitely a kind of Satanism in some Christian circles. Is there any truth behind that? Or do you know what the origin is about the peace symbol?
Yeah. I know what the origin is. And no, there's no truth behind it. It came from, and people should Google and not take my word for it because I may be misremembering some details. But it came from a British movement, I believe, called the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. In, I think, the 60s, I would assume, if I'm remembering right. And it was actually based on semaphores, you know, flag signs. And yeah. I can't remember exactly what it spells out. It's 2 or 3 flag signs superimposed over each other. It may be CND for nuclear disarmament, or it may be something else like STOP. It's been a while since I looked. I did look into that. I didn't personally know a lot of people who call it the twisted cross or the broken cross or the upside down cross or whatever. But I heard that on occasion And that's not a symbol I grew up with. That's something my wife and I have adopted as adults, as our pacifism has grown. And in particular, the attachment to campaigning against nuclear weapons there, that's a big deal to me. You know, it's one thing to say that people have a right to self-defense and maybe a right to just war. Maybe they do. But when you obliterate a city with a nuclear weapon, you are incinerating innocent people. You're incinerating babies. And my wife, her response to that whole concept, which I've taken as my own, is, look, if the price of my freedom is to kill an innocent baby, even just one, let alone a whole city, just let me be a slave.
Yeah.
So I take definitely that symbol as a nice little piece of subversion that, you know, I can put on things and people think we're just being cute and everything. And I'm like, no, really, we actually believe what that means.
I like that. So you definitely are coming from an anarchist, anti-government, but, you know, you don't really want the ATF or CIA knocking down your doors. But more fundamentally, you have the next symbol as the cross and the dove. So
yes,
while you give potential allowance for somebody who's not claiming to be a follower of Jesus to defend themselves or take up arms within reason, for yourself, you wouldn't do that because you're a follower of Jesus. So tell me a little bit about that, about the cross and where that comes in.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's absolutely correct, Drew. I am a Christian, and that's what the cross means. I call myself a fundamentalist because theologically, I'm roughly equal to what American fundamentalists said in the early 20th century, with the possible exception that in most people's mind, a fundamentalist is a really angry, judgmental person. And I think as Christians, we're called to not be that way. I think we're called to be loving. I think we're called to listen. You know, we're not supposed to be trying to straighten out the world with force in the name of Christ. We're just supposed to preach the truth and let people decide.
Mm-hmm. So what does voluntarism mean then? Is that a theological term or a political term?
That's a political term, and it comes from the libertarian movement. And depending on who you ask, it's either a synonym for libertarianism or it's a slightly different shade of meaning. The basic concept there is politically, I don't think people should be coerced into doing something that they don't feel like doing voluntarily. So, you know, while I believe that, you know, you and I should certainly give charitably, I don't believe in coercing people to give charitably. A better example, maybe, that I think hits a little more close to home is some people want to help out certain nations in the world that are facing military action right now. And if they feel called to do that, you know, fine. I think they should send their money, their resources, their themselves even. But to force other people to do that, I believe is wrong. And I'll add there's okay. really two sides to that make this a very strong held belief for me. One of them is just the moral issue. Is it right to coerce somebody? And the other one is the practical issue. I really do believe, you know, from what I've studied, from what I've learned in life, from what I've seen debated, I do believe that we are better off when society is not built on that level of coercion. We're better off economically. We're better off morally. We're certainly better off, you know, just the example I gave a minute ago, supporting war. Just think, you know, if the drastic wars in the Middle East from 20 years ago had only been supported by the people who believed in them and the rest of us got to opt out, just think how many more people would be alive.
Yeah. Yeah. And the domino impact of some of the decisions made, you know, for me, kind of coming of age politically in the late 90s, early 2000s, it has shaped, I'm thinking of George Bush and the WMD story and how that has really shaped a whole generation of people and how they view government and policies and frankly, you know, whole people groups. Although Islamophobia wasn't invented by George Bush. And frankly, George Bush was a lot less Islamophobic than a lot of the people that would have been in favor of going to war in Iraq, but I digress.
He was. No, that's a good digression. And in fact, can I take the opportunity to plug a book? It's not my book.
Yeah, absolutely.
you know, the thing about George Bush and the story of the weapons of mass destruction, which I believed, by the way, when all that was going on.
Oh,
down,
sure.
You know,
Rush Limbaugh
you'll
told
still
me so.
Find, yes, yes, Rush Limbaugh told me so, and all of his cohorts, and I believed him. But I have come to conclude that government pretty much always lies us into war, just like they did then. That was not a new playbook in 2002, 2003 at all. The Gulf of Tonkin, before my time, before your time, it was a lie. Mm-hmm. Franklin Roosevelt's involvement in what happened in Pearl Harbor is worth people looking into. He was not entirely on the up and up there, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a lot of historians. And you can go all the way back to Woodrow Wilson. These just and noble wars, and I'm not saying there was, you know, the other side was good or anything, but there's people who have a vested interest in lying us into war. And I'm a real big fan of the series of books called the Uncle Eric books. The author's name is Richard Mayberry. They're addressed to teenagers. It's written like a series of letters from a fictional uncle. And a lot of people have seen the first book in the series, Whatever Happened to Penny Candy. Mm-hmm. But as the series goes on, you get to like the 10th and 11th books, and he's talking about the Middle East wars and the world wars. And the data that he brings and the facts that he brings just really opened my eyes and really made me never trust again that government really had peace and safety at heart when it's trying to encourage us to support a war effort.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You had mentioned Richard Mayberry, I think is the name again.
Yes,
because
yeah,
I read those in my teens as well. Whatever Happened to Penny Candy, Whatever Happened to Justice, those two. And super, super impactful, maybe kind of a stereotype for, you know, somebody in their teens to like go hardcore in that direction. But he is at least a lucid and clear writer. And if you're interested in a sort of classic defense of libertarianism, I don't know if I agree with all of his arguments about some of the monetary policy stuff. It's a little too simplistic. But then again, that's what everybody always says. Oh, your view is too simplistic. So, but yeah, it's well worth checking out if you're curious about it. But so here's my question, David. And this gets to the last line in your Twitter bio. We'll talk about the middle part there about family and such and your church and what have you. But you say you're a proud non-voter. That's your like hashtag proud non-voter, kind of like the American flag I voted sticker in reverse.
Yeah.
So you're a non-voter. You're a follower of Jesus. You're committed to nonviolence. But you have a lot of strong opinions about politics. You follow politics, contemporary politics, I assume. Why would you
extent,
be involved?
Yeah.
Yeah, why would you have opinions about politics? Why would you care what happens in the kingdoms of this world if it's not your kingdom?
Well, you know, my basic opinion about politics is the same opinion I've been reiterating here, that I don't believe in violence and I don't believe in coercion. And I believe everybody and society as a whole would be better off if it were eliminated. So, you know, when you have a pair of policies to consider, you know, let's say Joe owns this plot of land here and the city wants to zone it for residential use, but he wants to use it for commercial use. To me, it's a no-brainer. The obvious better policy there is Joe owns the property. Let Joe decide. The rest of us are being coercive if we're telling him what he can or can't do there. Mm-hmm. And so my strong opinions about politics all basically amount to, you know, to one degree or another, let's lessen or eliminate the influence of politics over people, the influence of coercion over people.
Okay. And so what does this look like for you as a follower of Jesus? Basically, your view of politics is the less politics, the better. What are you involved in activism other than your rather prolific Twitter feed? Are you, you don't vote. Do you think it's a sin to vote? Are you involved in local politics?
I don't think it's a sin to vote. I do think we're not supposed to be trying to be controlling or coercing people. So there's, you know, it certainly could be sinful to vote to do something wrong or to vote for someone you know is going to do something wrong. And on that note, since you mentioned George W. Bush, I voted for him twice. And you know, in my opinion, there is blood on my hands. You know, I sent people to war because I believed it was necessary to vote for that man and because I believed what he was doing was right. The reason I go all the way and just completely step out of voting entirely is to kind of make a statement. And the statement is that the goals that most people are looking for when they vote aren't really the goals we should be looking for. You know, the goal is usually, how can I make my neighbor do what I think my neighbor ought to do? And that system, in my opinion, just doesn't work. Now, if you're voting to keep one of your neighbors from hurting your other neighbor, I think that's totally moral, totally right. But then you get into the question of effectiveness. You know, there's a lot of reasons to question what good does that really do. And I should round this up for you, but somewhere I have a long Twitter thread from a couple of years ago of just things that I suggest are better to do than voting. And things like sit down and read a book to a child does more good for the world than casting your vote at the ballot box. And a lot of people get, of course, really worked up at me saying this, you know, and I'm not one who likes to throw around the word idolatry too lightly, but it's like I've offended something religious in them, you know, and I understand. Sure. We've got a lot of people in the U.S. here who have been oppressed for generations, and I mm-hmm. recognize that many of them had no input in the government at all, beyond no input. I mean, of course, we have a legacy of slavery. I don't begrudge anybody wanting to make their voice heard in whatever way they think is effective, but I personally think the best way for me to press for a better world politically is to start trying to persuade people that we can do better than this system of winner takes all, majority rules. Let's make everybody do what we think is right.
Mm. Yeah, well said. And I do appreciate your point that, especially with folks that have been minorities or are minorities and have not been represented, that there may be a different conversation than what you and I would be having in relation
yes.
to, say, civil rights and such.
Yeah, and it's well worth pointing out, and many people have pointed out, David, you're saying this from a real position of privilege. Yes, I am. I am. You know, and if you think you've got to go do that, I'm not sitting here thinking, man, those terrible people. But I am sitting here saying, hey, we can do even better than this. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to convince people to think about that and listen to some ideas maybe they've never heard before, or maybe that they were raised to reject out of hand without considering. I'm trying to shift the Overton window just a little bit.
Mm, yeah, I like that. And the truth is that...
Let me just mention one other thing, too, since I brought up, you know, reading to a child. I'm raising kids. I'm raising 8 kids, which is an abnormally large number of children. They're not abnormal children, for the most part.
Uh-huh. Likely story.
But you know what? My kids, like most kids, they're turning out somewhat like me.
Yeah.
They don't believe in trying to straighten the world out through the force of government either. You know, if everybody wants to go convince them to vote, you know, great, that's 8 more votes for my family. But, you know, that I don't think that's the path to a better world.
Hmm. A lot of the folks in the audience listening to this are probably coming from an Anabaptist Mennonite background that would have a long tradition of not voting. And for you mm-hmm. to talk about trying to change the Overton window may actually feel a little strange to them, because they're coming from communities that, to suggest any sort of political involvement is so far outside their community's Overton window, it's hard for them to wrap their minds around. But the truth is that for a lot of us growing up listening to Rush yeah. Limbaugh, going to vote is considered like the most basic and most essential, you know, civic duty you have. And so to look at, especially again, to lean into the stereotype as a Midwesterner, especially for Texas, to say, yeah, I'm not going to vote, is actually a pretty profound step. That's exciting to hear and really interesting to hear your journey. Can you talk to us about your journey into nonviolence, coming from a conservative Christian background that again, yeah. from my stereotype, would be about political engagement and pro-military, you know, stars and stripes,
yes,
things like that. How did you come into that? What's your church background and was that part of it?
As growing up as a member of the Church of Christ, we did have a little bit of a different shade there from the standard rank and file evangelical or Baptist, but it was a real mixed bag history. David Lipscomb from Churches of Christ in the late 1800s, mm-hmm. early 1900s, he taught complete non-involvement in government, let alone war. But a lot of that got stamped out during the world wars. You got to the point where, you know, not only did people change their mind, they shamed those who did not. In fact, I can remember my dad telling me one time when I went to a church event as a teenager, he said, I just want you to know the man preaching at that event preached at something when I was a teenager, and he let us all know it was a sin to refuse to go to war because that was cowardice. I was kind of shocked because that wasn't really a pressing issue when I was growing up, like maybe it was for my dad. He was born in 1946. He filed conscientiously opposed with the selective service or the registration, whatever they called it in those days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they tried to kind of hammer on him and make him change his mind. In fact, they mm-hmm. demanded to interview him apart from his dad, my grandfather. And my grandfather told them, no, you won't let him vote on this and you want to send him to war. I'm not letting him out of my sight. He's still a child, apparently, since you won't let him vote. So you'll interview him with me. My grandfather was he served in the National Guard at some point during his life, Texas National Guard. But somewhere after that, he came to believe in Christian pacifism at some level. He did have a famous story mm-hmm. about a church guy decking an abusive husband who was screaming at his wife on the church parking lot. And he approved of that. So I know he didn't disapprove of swinging a fist, but he didn't believe in picking up arms and killing people. And my dad similarly did not. And I got some of that from them, maybe a little bit in my church culture. But like I said, a lot of that was really suppressed in the 20th century. But as you said, in the broader, you know, politically conservative evangelical church culture, the general viewpoint is law and order, peace through military strength. And that was all around. And it wasn't just all around, you know, outside of my family. It was in my family, too. We kind of had a dual view that, yes, God has authorized the state to do these things. He may have forbidden us to do these things, mm-hmm. but we still need that. And that was kind of my thinking growing up. I saw the first Iraq war start, didn't really understand what it was about, but certainly watching the first George Bush talk about it on TV, I was alarmed at whatever young age I was listening to that. Nowadays, I'm sure if I heard the same speech, I'd shrug and say, that has nothing to do with us.
Yeah, and then, I remember sitting at the kitchen table with my family during the Gulf Storm War or Operation. It's
Desert Storm.
Storm, thank you. And we would actually, we had the map, because we're a good homeschooling family, 8 kids at the time. And we had a map, a world map underneath on the kitchen table underneath plastic. And we could like kind of chart what was happening. You know, Kuwait is a small country, but we talked about what was happening and the DMZ and all that. And there was automatically a sense of we have the good guys and the bad guys. We have the Kuwaitis. We have the people that George H.W. is sending. And we hope the good guys win.
Yeah.
And you know, those messages are rarely deconstructed or considered. What does this look like from the other side? We have to be so thoughtful how we present those messages.
Yeah.
And are we, even if we're committed to nonviolence and to peace, are we giving that kind of message like, oh yeah, good guys, bad guys, you know, North Korea bad, South Korea good. But what about the actual people? So
yeah,
I just had to interject there my own memories. Yeah.
No, I 100% agree with everything you just said. And that was how it looked. And up through the September 11th attacks, that was how I parsed world events. There were the good guys. Mm-hmm. There were the bad guys. We wanted the good guys to win. I wasn't going to go. And, you know, if somebody had asked me, I would say, well, no, I don't think you should go. I think eventually we should all stop going as we all hopefully convert to the Prince of Peace. But in the meantime, we need that. Mm-hmm. And first, you know, September 11th made me angry. I would say murderously angry. I was the kind of guy who sat around and listened to people talk about retaliation and you know, nuke the whole Middle East into a radioactive glass parking lot, and I was high-fiving it and laughing it up, which is totally, you know, I was a hypocrite. Because on the one hand, I would think, hey, it's wrong to kill people, even for this, even in self-defense. And yet here I was with murderous retaliation on my heart. And I don't think I was alone in that. I'm sure a lot of people felt that way. In fact, I talked to family members who felt that way. We talked about that tension. And what really started to break it a year or so after the Iraq invasion. You know, I was continuing to listen to the Rush Limbaughs of the world and the conservative talk radio talking head guys. And I was hearing people online and occasionally in person express the opposite view. And, of course, my immediate reaction was something akin to Rush Limbaugh talking points, you know. Oh, come on, you don't know what you're talking about. We're all in danger. They're keeping us safe. They know what they're doing. And I had European acquaintances online. This was back before the days of social media, back when blogs were new, but there were still websites we interacted on. And they'd say, no, we don't hate America. We just believe you're acting wrong. We truly believe you're acting like an empire bent on dominating the world. And I'm sitting there going, you're crazy. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. But gradually, you know, my mind opened a little bit. I listened to points of view that I wanted to reject without listening to. And about that time, libertarianism was taking hold with me. And there's a lot of anti-war libertarians. There's not enough. There's a lot of libertarians who are really just Republican Party talking points who think they've got a great opportunity for a party they can control. But there were a lot of people who laid it on the line and explained in article after article as I read the history of things, the way governments got us into wars, what was really being accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And my mind changed. Simultaneously going through that, my wife and I got married in 2004. We met in 2002. She was homeschooled. I was not. As a homeschooled student, she was exposed to a lot of sources I was not exposed to, but still raised in a very conservative family. She was not pacifist. I was. She had a strong belief in the danger of a strong central government overriding local decisions, whereas I had the opposite belief. School had taught me it was important to have a strong central government. That was what you wanted to do. That was what the Constitution said to do. That was what was wrong before we had the Constitution. And we talked. We talked a lot. As in the early years of our marriage, unfortunately, we fought far more than any husband and wife should. But somehow, miraculously, we never fought about politics. I don't know why. You'd think that if anybody was going to fight about something, it would be politics. But for some reason, we listened to each other. And our viewpoints kind of merged. You know, we started changing points of what we believe. Oh, yeah, I do agree that the New Testament teaches that Jesus wanted us to put the sword down. Oh, yeah, I do agree that it's not the end of the world if a political subdivision secedes from another political subdivision. After all, that's what the United States did when it was formed. We came to really, really agree not only on, you know, what you might call the right answers, which that's our general philosophy that I'm expressing now, but just also on how important it was for people to start working for a world where people are free, where people are prosperous because they're not trying to dominate each other and trying to force a one-size-fits-all solution on everybody.
So that's really fascinating to hear this journey, because it kind of actually sounds like coming from a mainstream evangelical world with definitely a thread of nonviolence in your lineage, especially with the Church of Christ, and Campbell himself was a pacifist. Campbell being the founder of the Churches of Christ. Well, excuse me, Jesus was the founder of the Churches of Christ, right?
But yeah, I'm required by Church of Christ bylaws to interject that, but you already did it for me, Drew, so thank you.
Yeah,
you can call Campbell one of the earliest and strongest influences in our modern movement, and nobody would be offended by that, I think.
Yeah, and I'll interject, I come from a Church of Christ background too. My former co-host and I did a podcast episode on the history of the Church of Christ, where I tried to do some research and represent that tradition. I don't know if you listen to it, you may agree or disagree, but there's a bit of background there. But what I was thinking about is how your journey, it wasn't like the sharp turn away from politics and saying, ew, yuck. It was actually you're trying to stay faithful to convictions about politics and then walking step by step away from the inconsistencies as you moved further into trying to line up Christ and your politics.
A practice of trying to be more consistent, to take the principles that I thought should govern my life and our lives as human beings, and follow where they lead, follow where he leads.
Yeah. And there's so many people that look at nonviolence and they're like, oh, but what about, you know, the hypothetical, you know, rapist who breaks in? What about, you know, the people are going to bomb the US with weapons of mass destruction or whatever? But there's actually space there to start the conversations and to start thinking about it. And that's why I'm so glad we've spent time on your sort of libertarian perspective, moving you into nonviolence, because I think there's an exit ramp from empire that way.
There absolutely is. And I'm here to keep reminding people it's there, even if, like I said, some of us libertarians seem to be gun nuts who are happy to vote for whoever's waging the current war.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned briefly your marriage, and you mentioned to me too that that's something that you are pretty passionate about. A lot of our audience are single, but there are definitely married folks listening. So can you tell me some of your thoughts on marriage? Talk to me about that journey.
So I hinted at that a minute ago, in that when my wife Sarah and I got married, we ended up fighting a lot. We were just desperately in love. It was the kind of thing that made people sick to see us when we were dating. In fact, I got rebuked a time or two for being too physically affectionate. I'm not sure exactly what people thought
before
about me.
Before or after marriage?
Before marriage, I was rebuked for being.
Because I was rebuked a couple times after being a little bit too PDA after we were married, but our courtship was totally hands-off, so there wasn't too much rebuke before that.
We found each other just absolutely irresistible, and you get married and you think that's never going to go away. And we heard debates about that. We heard people say, yeah, that only lasts 2 years. Well, unfortunately for us, despite believing that that should last, 2 years later, we were fighting, just not all the time, but it felt like all the time. She was miserable. She was depressed. I was miserable. I was depressed. We were very disappointed. We started seeing a series of counselors. Eventually, I think we saw about 3 counselors. That seemed like the right thing to do, at least to me. My wife was really reluctant to do that, so I kind of dragged her, nudged her, twisted her arm. Come on, we got to do something. There's got to be a way to fix this. And they didn't really help, at least not long term. Sometimes it was kind of like a little shot in the arm, and there were some really, really bright moments in there. But they didn't really seem to offer long-term solutions and principles. And that's where I have to give, if it's okay, Drew, another shout out to a set of books and an author. Is that okay?
Yeah, and I might have a little bit of pushback to this author, but go for it.
Okay, fine. Dr. Willard Harley, author of His Needs, Her Needs. His website is marriagebuilders.com. We started following along there on, well, I started following along on his website. We started getting some help. We started working through the books. We found out why we were having so much trouble, and it had a lot to do with the way we were treating each other. As a matter of fact, it had specifically a lot to do with the fact that I was a raging, angry outburst machine. I'd lose my temper over anything. I wish I could say that I was never physical in that, but I can't, because I was at times physical. You know, the best thing about that program is it took a while, but Dr. Harley convinced me that I needed to eliminate angry outbursts from my life completely. There was a lot of other things that happened as well. My wife was starting an online relationship with another man. Unlike a lot of people, she eventually confessed that to me. Most people in that experience just kind of keep carrying it along until it's discovered or the unthinkable happens. We gave each other a lot to be upset about and a lot to be hurt about. But through the principles there, we learned how to stop hurting each other, how to start making each other happy, making each other feel love again, and how to negotiate through differences of opinion, negotiate through conflicts in a way that wasn't sacrifice and wasn't compromise, but would instead make us both enthusiastic about the decisions.
Mm-hmm. I read the Willard Harley book, His Needs, Her Needs, when I was either right before I married or right after. It was recommended by a friend in the ministry I was serving in at the time. And I was left, like, I appreciated it. I was left a little bit... Like, I again, this has been a while, but I read it felt like the main concept of the book was this love bank where he kind of reduced, or didn't reduce, but he kind of made the idea of the relationship as basically transactional, where you have a love bank and you can do things to please your spouse and that helps the marriage go well. But if you don't do enough, then that love bank will be empty and then it will be hard and you'll be drawing on deficits and stuff. Is that the main concept from the book, or am I just remembering one little tiny piece?
In a way it is, and in a way it isn't. It kind of depends on what situation you're in. So when Dr. Harley works with a couple, if he can persuade them to both start making those deposits that he calls the love bank deposits, the end result will be they will eventually be in love again, and they'll be doing that, you know, not trying to make themselves do it and drag themselves through it. They'll feel like doing it. That's been his experience. However, in a lot of real-world cases, he can't persuade both husband and wife to do that. So you don't get a transactional situation. You actually get a situation which is what Sarah and I had, where you have one spouse trying to work the program, and believe it or not, that was me, and one spouse who's just completely reluctant about it, dragging their feet. Sarah, at that point, she'd been to three counselors. She'd talked about personal things she didn't want to talk about. She had dealt with the broken heart that I had caused. She had dealt with the fact that she was married to this man she thought was a dream, who was now an abusive nightmare, not to mention just a big disappointment. And so a lot of times with the people trying to follow Dr. Harley's approach, you end up with one spouse making those deposits and the other one not. And that can be rough. That's hard to sustain. As a matter of fact, this is where, believe it or not, Dr. Harley takes a lot of heat for this. Yeah. As a Twitter denizen, you're very familiar with the complementarian, egalitarian debate. Dr. Harley gets flack from both sides on that. And one of the things he says that just really upsets a lot of people is he believes men tend to have more stamina in a situation of trying to win back a reluctant wife than women do trying to win back a reluctant husband. As a matter of fact, if there's abuse or infidelity in the situation, he tells wives to start planning a separation immediately and not prolong that winning back time any longer than they have to. Hold it down to a matter of weeks. Whereas with a man, and he told me this personally, he says, look, your ability to handle rejection is stronger than hers. You can last longer. Do what you need to do. Even if it is a little bit at the expense of your health, for the sake of your wife and your children, keep going as long as you possibly can. And when you feel like you can't go any longer, see a doctor. Get some short-term or even long-term antidepressant medicine just to keep yourself rocking along and doing it. And I had to do that.
That especially seems valid in the sense that, I mean, not to paint you like a monster, but you kind of did. Like, if you were being physically abusive at times, emotionally abusive, but absolutely, you being called to lay your life down and instead being physically and emotionally abusive, for you then to give 100% and to be pouring into the quote unquote love bank seems especially appropriate. Can I just to clear a few things off the table then?
Sure.
You wouldn't advocate for I'll just ask the push pull question here. You wouldn't advocate for a woman staying in an abusive relationship, especially with physical abuse. Is that correct?
No. No, I would not, and I follow Dr. Harley's recommendation strenuously on that. If a woman's husband is physically abusive, she needs to be encouraged to file a police report, and she needs to separate as soon as possible. If he's emotionally abusive, she needs to start planning that separation, figuring out how she's going to support herself, what are her legal options. You got two types of men. You got the kind of man that you draw a line for him and say, hey, you're going to have to raise the bar here. You're going to have to come up to this standard. And he does it. And you've got the kind of man who pushes back against that and justifies himself and says no. And you would not believe how many times you see that guy and he plummets to the depths of depravity, of what men are capable of. The men who won't raise the bar turn out to be scoundrels. They really do. And I mean, there, but for the grace of God go I. It's a cliche, but we're all faced with a choice.
Yeah. Let me ask you one more question too. I've read some pushback from folks like Ray Gregoire, who we've had on the podcast before, and she'll be on the podcast within the next month or two again, specifically calling out some of Dr. Harley's counsel, and she sees it as basically saying, well, women, it's not, and I wasn't planning on going here, but so I hope it's okay. This is supposed to be nonviolence and stuff. Yeah, she would emphasize, and let me say too, just because something helps one person or helps a lot of people doesn't mean that it's all good then. So just because it's helped you and God's used that for you, it doesn't mean that somebody should take that as a total endorsement of everything, or that other people could take it and take it to bad places. So with all that said, here's my question. Dr. Harley talks about, it appears that a woman has a responsibility to keep herself looking beautiful, fit and trim, and to provide sexual pleasure for her husband. And if she doesn't fill that love bank, sexual pleasure, if she's not satisfying her husband sexually, she may have culpability in his struggle with porn or his leaving her. And I remember even reading a story he told in the book, again, years ago, where he talks about a guy going and having an affair because his wife wasn't satisfying him sexually. And he made it clear that it was his fault, but also she should have done more.
Here's the thing. I've got a lot of context for what Dr. Willard Harley and his wife Joyce believe on that subject, because I sat down and, I mean, I listened on the way to work and on my walks and on the way home day after day for years to his radio program where both he and his wife talk about these things. And I get that Sheila Gregoire doesn't have that much context, but I wish that she and some of the other authors talking about it would reach out to him and to Joyce Harley, his wife, and discuss these things with him. The chapter on physical appearance in Dr. Harley's book has been revised like 5,000 or 4,000 times. If you look it up, there's been edition after edition of His Needs, Her Needs, and he's made a lot of adjustments based on feedback, and that is the most adjusted piece of his writing ever. First off, Joyce especially is the first to point out, for infidelity, for abuse, for a whole host of other issues, there may be what we might call reasons for why people make bad decisions, but there are no excuses. So, for example, I was a husband with an anger problem. Well, my wife was not meeting my emotional needs. She was abusing me. She'll freely admit that. And she started an affair online. A lot of people would say, well, David, you had plenty of cause to be angry. Well, maybe I did. There were reasons, but that doesn't excuse that. That doesn't make what I did not abusive. It was wrong. Mm-hmm. It was 100% wrong. We choose how we respond to what other people do. As far as meeting any emotional needs, what Dr. Harley always tries to emphasize, and it obviously has not come through in some of his books, especially when excerpts are taken, meeting emotional needs has to be done according to what Dr. Harley calls the policy of joint agreement. And the policy of joint agreement, it's one of his fundamental concepts. The policy of joint agreement says everything you do in marriage must be something that is done with enthusiastic agreement between husband and wife. So as an example, I used to go out and eat lunch every day, and one day my wife told me that bothered her. According to the rules of marriage builders, that meant I stopped going out to lunch every day. Now, a lot of people would say, hey, that doesn't affect her. You know, you're too far away from home to get home for lunch. You got to eat lunch somewhere. It's not affecting her at all. You're not overspending. She shouldn't let it bother her. Well, no, it did bother her, and it didn't matter why it bothered her. My need for food had to be met in a way that Sarah was enthusiastic about as a part of my care for Sarah. And here's the real, I did say I wholeheartedly endorse all of Dr. Harley's stuff, and I do. The problem with His Needs, Her Needs is it's half of a program. The other half is his book, Love Busters. And Love Busters is the book that explains you can't demand anything from your spouse, even if you need it. Now, he does explain that in His Needs, Her Needs, but that's not really his focus there. His focus is on, let me help you learn to meet needs you may not be able to meet. For example, let me help men learn to have better conversations that their wives will enjoy. Let me help you arrange finances in a way that make everybody feel provided for, arrange domestic support in a way that makes everybody feel provided for. But none of that works if you're engaging in demands, disrespectful judgments, or angry outbursts. If either one of you is doing that, and this is where Dr. Harley gets stricter than just about anybody else I know, Dr. Harley says just the demands are abusive. So, I mean, he openly called me abusive because of angry outbursts, but if I had just been demanding or disrespectful, he still would have called me an abusive husband. I didn't want to hear that when I first got there, but it's true. You know, when you marry someone, did you marry them to care for them and to love each other, or did you marry them to get a slave? And that goes for husbands and wives. So in the context of meeting needs for physical attractiveness, you know, it all comes down to, are you both enthusiastic about this? And if you're not both enthusiastic about it, you got to find something, you know, that's in that Venn diagram intersection. You and I on Twitter, we're familiar with all the Venn diagram memes with the two circles. Sure. You know, what's in there that you're both enthusiastic about? And you're right, Drew, that the earlier editions of His Needs, Her Needs, because Dr. Harley had seen so much infidelity and was so very concerned with the subject, they hit definitely a little bit too hard on the idea that this is part of how to affair-proof your marriage. This is part of how to make sure nobody ever wants to look outside of the marriage. Mm-hmm. On the radio, for years, he's made it clear that doesn't mean that's what causes infidelity. And in fact, that latest revision of His Needs, Her Needs has removed the tagline entirely. I used to recommend one of his other books, His Needs, Her Needs for Parents, which is, it's a little bit abbreviated, but it doesn't have that constant warning, there could be an affair siren song going on. Now, now the thing is, the warnings about affairs, they're right. They're serious. That doesn't mean that, you know, a man who uses pornography or commits adultery is justified because his wife didn't meet his needs, or vice versa.
Yep.
But according to Dr. Harley's statistics, 60% of marriages have infidelity. And I'm not sure what year he got that statistic, but it is so phenomenally common. It's hard to get good numbers on that because a lot of people don't want to talk about it. My wife had a discussion the other day on Twitter, one of the latest controversies, a lady divorcing her husband and several people saying, oh, she has no cause to do that. And my wife was just kind of trying to gently say, you don't know what cause she's got for that. Yep. Because the truth is, a lot of people don't talk about it. It happens.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot there.
Thanks for letting me defend all that so passionately. I've been there and I've had these discussions a lot.
Yeah, and I think it's really good because, as you know, and some of our listeners may have followed too, there is a lot of discussion around this. Some of the sort of legacy marriage teachers like Dr. Harley or Emerson Eggerichs, James Dobson, of course, there's some really valuable pushback and concern about some of the core messages, yes, and also some of how people that are in vulnerable places have received these messages and what it looks like to take a message like, his needs, her needs, you both need to serve each other. Like it can be a devastating message to give to somebody who's in an abusive relationship.
Yeah. And then sometimes Dr. Harley's full message is if you're a lady and your spouse is abusing you, you can't make them stop. You can't. Yeah. And that is touched on in his needs, her needs, at least back in the 2010 or 2012 edition. I hope he's expanded it a bit more in the latest one. But if you get towards the back there, he talks about what he calls the love busters and what they do.
Yep.
He talks about what causes affairs. He talks about the need to separate rather than believing you can control your spouse and fix them by meeting all their needs. I won't deny that he needs to talk about it more. I will.
Sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt you so much. I will request that people consider that he is different from Dobson and different from Eggerich. I know my wife definitely thinks he's different from Eggerich. She despises Eggerich's advice with a passion. And to just put it really, really in stark relief, the impression that a lot of people, particularly in our Twitter circles, have of Dr. Harley is that he's a sexist. And I have heard hundreds of hours of what he has to say, and I've heard him talk with his wife. I've heard his wife for hundreds of hours as well, and he's not. They've sheltered abused women in their home. They are egalitarian in theology. I would love for Sheila Grigoire or some of the other authors that I've seen on Twitter to actually reach out to Dr. Harley and Joyce with their concerns and discuss these things. I would love to see them talk to them about that. And I believe that the Harleys would love to receive that because they've been receiving this kind of feedback for decades now. It's a hard message to get across. He won't deny that it can be improved, but he's not the sexist that people are making him out to be.
And I think one of the reasons that counseling as a category, as a skill set, as a ministry is so hard is because you can, in my work as a pastor, which is somewhat limited, my work as a church planter, working with folks internationally, I could give advice to somebody that a lot of times would be really helpful to them. Sometimes it wouldn't, but I could give specific counsel to an individual person. I know their situation and I can walk with them and we can have this dialogue back and forth. But if I take that piece of counsel or one piece of counsel from that conversation I had with them and I stick it in a book and I publish it, I've lost control of the context. I've lost control of how it's being applied, and yet I'm still accountable for it. And frankly, I think if I'm going to publish a book that has specific counsel to somebody, and you can disagree with me, David, if I'm publishing a book that has specific counsel to people that I don't know, I probably should be held accountable for how that counsel is applied. I'm thinking about James, where he talks about not many of us should be teachers, and he didn't. Yeah. They didn't have a printing press back then, much less social media and podcasts. And so it's so important that we be careful. And maybe I am coming around to say, take a book that gives counsel on marriage or counsel on parenting or counsel on, healing from trauma, and take it with a huge grain of salt, because this is not the same as walking one-on-one in real life, with skin in the game physically. It's not the same thing.
Well, let me ask, what would you think he needs to do to up his accountability on this?
So I'm just looking at Sheila Ray Gregoire's book as you talk. And again, she's one voice I really appreciate and think is super needful. That doesn't mean I agree with everything she says either. So what she objects to is that she has a quote here from Harley. She, the woman, should try to look the way her husband likes her to look. She should resemble the woman he married. Does that mean a woman must stay eternally young? Of course not, but getting old is not an excuse for gaining weight and dressing like a bag lady. And that feels very condescending to Gregoire, and I think it makes sense. He also talks about...
So let me ask this. Is the problem the wording there, or is the problem the concept?
Mm-hmm. I think there's the way I read it in the book, in Gregoire's book, and honestly, I think maybe the way I took it from when I read the book as a very young man, 15, 16 years ago, it felt like to me, it's like, she needs to do these things because I'm doing these things. And if I do these things and she does these things, then it'll be okay. But if she doesn't do enough of these things, then there will start to be a deficit and we need to build it back up again. And the way I took it, it did feel pretty transactional. And the way you're framing it, David, and with your background with Dr. Harley, having drunk of those wells much more deeply than I have, I hear what you're saying is that as a couple, you're saying, how can we help each other? We have a shared goal to make this marriage work. Maybe it's in a good place, maybe it's in a bad place, but we are coming into these shared agreements to say, this is what we want. And if she doesn't want to do that, if he doesn't want to do that, that's a conversation. You're not like saying, well, you promised to do this, or, you know, you put on an extra 10 pounds, so I'm going to go look at porn. And it gets really icky when you think about a lot of
everything you just said is stuff Dr. Harley would agree with.
Yeah. And why I brought up the idea of how books that delve into counseling and marriage, I remember not even liking the book that much when I was, 15 years ago when I was first married, because it felt so transactional. Mm-hmm. But he was giving advice to maybe somebody like you and your wife, and it hit me differently. And this is why we need to hold these books with an open hand and really be thoughtful, yes, how we write them, but the very principle, the principle that was so helpful to you felt off to me. Is the principle right or wrong? Yeah. Well, the way I interpret it may have been wrong. The way you interpret it seems like it was profoundly helpful.
Well, I was asking just now about the principle of physical appearance, but it sounds like you're getting at the principle of the love bank itself, which, he explains in his counseling book, this is a model. It's a theory as to how the mind works, mm-hmm. but it's a theory that he and me too, to a lesser extent, we've seen it borne out.
Yeah.
If you give your attention to making your spouse happy, now I'm not talking about giving into abuse. Mm-hmm. If you give your attention to caring for your spouse, doing things to make your spouse feel loved, and avoiding doing things that make your spouse unhappy, and avoiding a life that is filled with actions on either of your part that the other's reluctant about.
Yeah.
The feeling of romantic love is the inevitable result. And there's never been anyone who's tried that. I'm not talking about one-sidedly trying it, but both-sidedly trying it and done it, that hasn't happened.
And I think that's such a profound point, because so many of us are reading this in such a context of brokenness, it's hard for us to see it in mutuality. And maybe, mm-hmm. Dr. Harley, you said he's coming from an egalitarian perspective. I would come from a broadly complementarian perspective theologically, mm-hmm. in my marriage, a little different story. But complementarianism is so, in marriage, so often it feels very one-sided. And so maybe it's the folks like Egerix that have kind of skewed the message that we only hear somebody like Dr. Harley one way. But it's scripture to say that a husband should love his wife as Christ loved the church, and a wife should love her husband and honor her husband. Like, that's scripture. And in fact, that we're all supposed to honor each other and submit to one another in love. It sounds like what you're talking about is you and your wife fundamentally discovered 1 Corinthians 13. And you can't get away from that.
Absolutely.
We talked about this at the beginning, the difference between doing something out of love versus doing something out of coercion. And you're saying that you and your wife wanted to make the marriage work, or maybe your wife didn't want to initially and you kind of leaned in on it.
But we learned how to motivate each other is what we learned.
Yes. And you weren't coercive. You didn't threaten each other.
Once I learned to not be abusive, yes, I was not coercive.
Yeah. Really, really interesting. To kind of wrap up on one point, and there's so much more I'd like to talk with you about music, because you're coming from the Church of Christ. You have 8 kids that sing. I'd love to talk with that. But you talked about this theme of anger in your marriage. And just kind of your own personal journey, even apart from marriage, what does your journey look like in overcoming anger?
I am very fortunate that my wife's emotions would not put up with my anger. I really am. A lot of people have been raised to put up with that. She was to some extent raised to put up with that, maybe not as much as a lot of people we know. And she tried, and her heart just couldn't take it. It just made her more and more resentful, more and more, she'd try to make herself do one thing and find herself doing another because she resented the way I was treating her so very much. She started hearing, well, wait a minute, this Dr. Harley guy, he takes an absolute stance against anger. When are you going to do that, David? When are you going to actually live up to what he's saying here and eliminate angry outbursts? And finally, literally under his advice, after directly talking to him, she said, okay, that's it. You can't come home anymore. until you can guarantee you're never going to have another angry outburst as long as we live in my presence. And I spent 2 or 3 weeks in a Super 8 motel here in East Texas. I used to call this Super 8 motel therapy a few years later, because that was some thinking time, Drew. That was some major thinking time. You know, you quoted scripture to us a minute ago. You know, a husband's supposed to lay down his life for his wife. Well, I mean, if you're going to lay your life down for her, how much easier should it be to live with her in an understanding way, to not yell at her, to not be judgmental and disrespectful towards mm-hmm. her, to not have angry outbursts and try to punish her? She's not your child. Not in any theological model of Christian marriage that I've ever heard is your wife your child. I'm sure we can find the internet wackos who disagree with me there, but she's not. And so I finally ran up against this wall. Unbeknownst to me, Sarah was getting ready to change the locks if I had refused. If I had said, no, there's no reason for that. I'm going to work things out here. Everything's going to be okay, dear. It's going to be fine. Just trust me. She was getting ready to make very, very good on that. And it was an interesting week. It was vacation Bible school at our church. So every night we were sitting there watching the kids have great fun at vacation Bible school. And then we'd go home, kiss them, put them to bed, say goodnight, and then I'd leave. And depending on how she was feeling, you know, she might say something nice to me on the way out, or she might not. Dr. Harley told her she didn't have to do anything she didn't feel like at that point. And you know, you put all that in the cold, stark reality a day there. I had to come face to face with how I made my wife feel and the fact that nobody could fix that but me. She couldn't fix that. I had to fix that. I was the one who'd done it. And I came at this with a belief that this was my last straw, my last ditch effort. There was no hope for us if this didn't work, and there was no way for this plan to work if I didn't get some serious anger management therapy and learn how to stop having angry outbursts. Not just say I was working on it, which I did for a couple of years. I have since come to say, you know, all that time I said I was working on it, that was just code for doing nothing, because that's what it was. Yeah. I wasn't doing anything. What were you doing to work on it, David? Can you be specific? And so getting that help, getting to the point where there was no way forward except to finally do what Jesus had told me to do for years and put aside my anger and wrath and malice, that changed me in so very many ways. And it was all for marriage. It was all for Sarah and our kids and our family. But it changed the way I view everything. Interpersonal relationships, on church disputes, on theological disputes. Theologically, I'm still basically the same guy who grew up in the Church of Christ with the same mm-hmm. unique beliefs most people in that church has, but the way I think we handle those disagreements is totally different. Years ago, I remember standing up in a Sunday morning class and griping at some guy because he'd suggested we change something that I thought was a key point of theology or practice in Churches of Christ, and I remember mm-hmm. my wife, Sarah, just being horrified, you know, oh my goodness, he's out of control. What's he going to do? What's he going to say? That's unthinkable now. You know what? Lots of people disagree with me, and that's okay. Yeah. I have no choice but to respect that and accept that like a grown-up, Drew, like a decent human being.
It's so fascinating that you would go there with this anger to talk about church stuff. And how often have I and have others experienced, and maybe if we're honest, given it out, responses in the church that may sound holy, may sound like I'm shooting for the straight and narrow, but are actually motivated by anger. And how is that mm-hmm. like Jesus?
Yeah. And you just described how I lived for years and years and years, you know, and it angry people don't just do it about church stuff, but if they are church people, we have a lot of church excuses.
You know, I think about how the scriptures talk about, you know, striving to live at peace and making an effort to live at peace. It's like sometimes it takes work to do that. But like you said before, you had been saying, oh, I'm going to put away anger, and you never actually did it. And that actually doing mm-hmm. it, as you kind of started to explain, is taking practical steps, you know, conditioning yourself to actually have different responses to it rather than anger. Yeah,
exactly. Replace that habit and that instinct with a new habit that you've just practiced and practiced and practiced. And while you're practicing it, you know, learn to keep quiet. One of the other therapists whose material I read, and I even called this guy up on the phone once or twice to get some help, his book, he worked with convicts at one point in a prison anger management program. And I'm trying to remember exactly how he worded it, but one of these guys asked him, look, what do I have to do to stop having these angry outbursts and finally meet the goals that the people working with me are wanting me to meet here? And Hightower wrote down something to the effect of, when you're feeling upset, stop talking. And the guy looks at him and says, this is it? You got to be kidding. And Hightower, the guy's name was Newton Hightower, that's the therapist's name, he takes the card back, turns it over, and writes down, shut up, and hands it back to him. And it's good advice. It's such very, very good advice.
Well, and it's profoundly biblical advice, too.
It is.
I think we spend way too much time in the book of Romans pounding out our systematic theology and not enough time in the book of James.
But I would agree with that.
That's another conversation. David, I really appreciate you taking the time, and you've given me a lot to think about, and I hope we can continue the conversation and friendship as we move forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Drew. I appreciate this very much. I'm honored to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been awesome. Blessings.
That Jesus Podcast is part of the Kingdom Outpost Podcast Network. For more articles, podcasts, and other resources, go to kingdomoutpost.org.